Okay. Thank you so much for inviting me to come out to speak to you tonight, and Brishas, the Rebbetzins, and the Hanhala members, and anybody else who is here. I feel very privileged to be standing up at the front of this room, and I think it's part of the trajectory of my life over the last 9 years, where I'm doing things that I never thought I would be doing. If you would have told me 9 years ago that I'd be standing speaking at a sisterhood meeting, I wouldn't have believed you. If you would have told me that, 9 years ago that I would have been speaking in Ramat Beit Shemesh to something like 200 ladies, I wouldn't believe you either. Some of the things that I'm going to tell you tonight, I still don't believe them, but I wanted to share them with you and to give you a perspective that maybe you can take with you and you can use it in your daily life. But before I do, I just want to say that I want to dedicate tonight's shir le'Eloi Nishmas, my mother, Rachaleya Bas Aaron HaKohen, whose fourth yahrzeit was just last week. And the Mesiras Nefesh that my mother had for Torah was surely an example and an inspiration for all who knew her. And it's, definitely made me who I am today. And the Mesiras Nefesh that I learned from her is something that, can't be copied. As well, Eloi Nishmas, my husband, Yehuda Pinchas ben Yitzchak Isaac, whose Mesiras Nefesh, to live a life of Kiddush Hashem and to be an Obed Hashem, was non-parallel, something that I could not even keep up with, and I'll try to just give you a little glimpse of what that meant. So for those of you who don't know my story, I really feel like, not loud enough. Okay. So for those of you who don't know my story, I'll give you a little background. I started out, I was just like all of you. I grew up in Forest Hills. My father was a member of the yeshiva. My father was the mashgiach for night seder. He's the baal tokeya for the yeshiva. I grew up in the yeshiva family. My earliest memories are of me, as a little kid, running around in yeshiva, and coming to yeshiva on Shabbos, and just growing up within the yeshiva community, walking home Shabbos morning from yeshiva davening with my father, walking the Rosh Yeshiva home to his house and getting a lolly, and just really the yeshiva was much, much smaller, 35, 45 years ago. We knew who everybody was. You could, probably count them on two hands, and that's what I grew up with, knowing that Torah and Habatzas HaTorah is something which is an ideal, something which we strive for, and something where we want to go out there and share the love of our heritage with people who are less fortunate than us. And, to know that, they're waiting for us, that we're they're out there and they just don't know what they're missing, and we need to share with them that which they don't have. So when I married my husband, we were learning in Kol. I said we were learning Kol. Well, he was learning in Kol. I was running the show. And we talked about living out of town and moving out of town and being Marbitzei Torah. So we were kind of discussing what out of town meant. I grew up in Forest Hills. I thought that was out of town enough. Anyone who, from Brooklyn, never even heard of Queens, forget it. They never went that far. So Forest Hills was out of town. I talked about going out of town, and I said, sure, Chicago. And he's like, no, Chicago's just like New York. And I'm like, are you kidding me? No way, it's so far. And he said, well, no, that's too big of a town. My husband grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. So St. Paul, Minnesota is teeny weeny, okay? Like he had however many boys in his class, and of them, how many were Shomer Shabbos? The Rungis, I think, was his only firm friend that he had growing up in St. Paul, Minnesota. So to him, Chicago was like way too huge. He had gone to WITS, like, no, small town it was. I said, okay. So we talked about it and we compromised. I said, okay, here are my two conditions. I want to be someplace within a somewhat decent driving distance to New York. I wasn't sure at the time what that meant, but decent, I guess, is a relative term. I figured, if we're doing this Harbatzas HaTorah thing and we have a family, we're not having money to drive, to fly everybody home to visit the family. And, my parents are also, also were into this Hepbus Centaur thing, so they weren't going to come visit me either. So I was like, well, family's important. I want to be able to see my family. It has to be somewhere where I can get into the car and get to. My other criteria was that I had a boy and four girls at the time. And I said, okay, so my son will end up in WITS or OTI or PTI or something TI or IT or whatever, you know. He'll end up in one of the branches somewhere. That's okay. I could see sending away a high school age son. That's not so unheard of. But my girls, I'm not sending away my girls. Who sends away the girls? You don't go somewhere and then your girls have to go away for school. Not happening. So it came time. My husband got smicha. We were looking to go out of town. And a position opened up in Ottawa, Canada. So I had heard a little bit of Ottawa. We knew the Shapses, they were there. David and Suzanne Berger were there. The Shakins had moved there, were moving there that summer. It sounded like okay. There were Chafetz Chaim people. It's only an 8-hour drive to New York. So that meant like you could leave in the morning and be there by the evening. We did it once with my kids. We left, it was a holiday morning, so I think we left at 7:30 in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning. And we pulled into the Young Israel Forest Hills from Mincha like at 4 o'clock. And my kids say to me, do you mean, Ma, that we are in school for more hours than it takes to drive to New York? And I'm like, yeah, I guess so. So you see, it was a very quick drive to New York. And there was a girls' high school. So perfect, girls' high school, drive to New York. Excellent. So we moved to Ottawa. And all those stories about Habatzas HaTorah and everything that we learned about in yeshiva and having people over for Shabbos and everything. So my husband was teaching in the community day school, which at the time had about 450 to 500 kids. And he was teaching a special Torah track. There was maybe a handful of kids in the school that were Shomer Shabbos. Everybody else was from all kinds of affiliation. Many of them had never actually learned Chumash inside for real ever. And they had Rabbi Berger, but they had very little exposure to authentic Torah and authentic Judaism. And the Rosh Yeshiva always said, they're waiting for us. We were just like spellbound to just actually see he was right. You know, not to tell him that he was wrong, but to see it with our own eyes, how these kids and their families were just lapping it up. They couldn't get enough. My husband found some kids at recess time. They had cut recess. He couldn't find them. And where were they? So, I mean, the story is funny but sad at the same time. He was giving a Chumash test, and they wanted to do well on the Chumash test. So they cut recess and they were studying Chumash in the bathroom. So it's sad, but just, you know, that's what they were doing. They just were lapping it up. So we had these kids over Shabbosim. We had their families over. We had Hanukkah parties, Sukkot parties. Every party, every Yom Tov came with a party. It was, you know, every night he taught multiple classes. So every night of Hanukkah was another class. It was just like continuous. Like everybody knew. You know, my kids all knew the drill, you know, all the games that we played, it was just like repeat, you know, night one, night two, night three, repeat. And they all knew, and every year we repeated it for the next class, and we had Shabbatons, and we had other things, and we had the families over, and then my husband started with somebody else, they started a new program called Torah High. So Torah High is part of MCSY, it's a special after-school program for high school kids that get college credit, like they get like college, university level credit so they could finish high school faster. So basically the idea is that if you get the kids to come for at least one class for each of their 4 years of high school, they could finish earlier and then you could send them to Israel and they could, you know, join other programs and other things. And at its peak under my husband's guidance, there were 100 kids. That came. It started at nothing, and there were 100 kids. So I was teaching in the community school, in the Torah school, and life was perfect. Like, this was the dream. Like, this was what we always talked about, what we were going to do. We were going to go with our family. We were going to go out of town. We were going to be Marbitzei Torah, raise a family out of town to be examples of what a Torah family is. And everything was going like clockwork, you know, just... You know, it just, as predictable, you know, you had your, you know, my kids still had tantrums and, you know, and they got sick and whatever. whatever else, you know, daily grind, you know, babysitter cancels, you know, things like that. But otherwise, you know, life was fairly typical. And then, what happened? My daughter, who was only going into second grade at the time when we moved to Ottawa, was in seventh grade. And that girls' school that I told you about, that was like the only reason that I agreed to go to Ottawa for, closed down. So, I'm like, okay, Hashem, you got me where you wanted me. Now what? You know? So, my daughter, there was no school for her. So, I started to send away my kids for school. So, ironically, my son stayed at the OTI, at the Chafetz Chaim High School in Ottawa. And my daughter went away to Montreal because it was 2 hours away from Ottawa. So, she boarded over there. We figured either close to home or with family. And that was about as close to home as you could get. And then the next year, my sister and her husband moved to Rochester because my brother-in-law was going to be the principal of the girls' high school there. So it came time for my daughter, Malka, to go to high school, and she was going to go and live by my sister. She was going to go to Rochester. It was the end. It was her. She was in eighth grade. It was the end of the year. It was in June. And we decided that as part of her getting ready for going to Rochester the next year in September, we were going to go as a family for Shabbos and attend the 12th grade graduation of Ora Academy. Just to, you know, see the girls, meet the girls, kind of get a foot in the door and see what was going on. And that's where life as planned took a detour. Because on the way home from Rochester, I had almost all of my children in the cars, my husband and I. My son was not with us. It was my girls and my son, and I was expecting our ninth child at the time, and we were driving home from Rochester to Ottawa, and a deer came across the road. And I had very little time to process, very little time to think, what do you do when a deer juts out in the road? And my first impulse was, I need to save my family. I can't hit the deer because I heard all these horror stories about when a deer comes through the windshield, how much damage is done to the people inside. So I swerve to avoid hitting the deer, and in doing so, lost control of the car, and the car flipped several times. And at first, I thought we were going to flip. I wasn't sure if we flipped. You know, time was passing and slowly and, you know, kind of in and out. I wasn't really sure what was happening. And then when I next opened up my eyes, the car was standing right side up. So I was kind of relieved to see that, oh, you know, we hadn't flipped after all. But in reality, we had rolled so many times that we just ended up right where we started from, but we were no longer on the road. We were on a ditch off on the side of the road. And, you know, I could describe to you the scene. It was pretty horrible. Basically, it was Chasdei Hashem. It was Nisim that none of us were killed. The car looked like a tuna can. The car was demolished. It was all bent in. It was all banged up. The windows were blown out. But everybody was alive. And everybody was responsive. And nobody, the biggest injury that we knew of immediately was that my daughter had some kind of gash on her head that needed some stitches. So, you know, we all come piling out of the car on the side of the road trying to, like, ascertain the damage and figure out what's going on and what just happened and just figure it all out. And my husband was still in the car. He couldn't get out of the car. And I was in shock. And he's saying, Shingle, I can't get out. I can't move. I said, that's okay. Don't worry. I see fire engines. I see police cars. They're going to come. They'll get you out. Don't worry. They're going to get you out. And he's like, but I can't move. I'm like, don't worry. You're stuck. The car is all banged in. Don't worry. They're going to get you out. And I'm like coming out. And my daughter's saying, Mommy, Mommy, look. It's a nace. It's a nace. We're all alive. I said, yeah, we're going to have a Sudas Havda'a one day. Yeah, look, it's great. And, you know, the kids are all coming out of the car. The younger ones were being helped by the older ones. Everyone comes out. Everyone's all intact. And then the personnel come over to me and they go, ma'am,
we need to help you. And I'm like, no, I'm okay. And they go, ma'am, are you expecting? And I'm like looking at them, excuse me, like, who are you? Like, hello? Like, none of your business? Like, why are you asking me that? And I just said, no, I'm not. So this was in June and I was due in September. I was very pregnant, you know? And it was like, and he's like, ma'am, are you sure? And I'm like, no, I'm not. And I'm thinking, stop with the personal questions. And he's like, he's silent, and I'm thinking this guy is off the wall and embarrassing. And meantime, though, my kids were panicking. They're like, ma, ma, didn't you tell us we're having a baby at Rosh Hashanah time? And I'm like, what? And they're like, poor kids, they thought I lost it. They're like, ma, baby, Rosh Hashanah. And I'm like, oh, yeah, 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 I'm pregnant. And he's like, oh, when are you due? I go, I don't know. And my kids are like, ma, Rosh Hashanah. I'm like, yeah, yeah, September. He's like, okay, I think we need to take you with us. And I'm like, I'm not going anywhere with you. My kids are here. Like, I'm not leaving my kids. It's 10 o'clock at night. It's pitch black. I'm not leaving my kids on the side of the highway. Like, are you kidding? No. And like, ma'am, we need to go and check you out. We need to figure out what's going on with you. It's not safe. Well, I'm not leaving my kids. I'm not. And they said, you need to come with us. They got down, you know, like when you get down on the level of a two-year-old and you look at them straight in the eye and they listen to me. And they said to me, listen, we will be in charge of your kids. They're going to meet you at the hospital. We are taking you to get checked out, and they're going to follow. And I had no choice. They got me out of there. I wasn't even registering that my husband was still in the car and that he hadn't come out yet, because I figured, okay, they're taking me to the hospital. They'll get him out of the car. They'll take him to the hospital. My kids will meet us at the hospital, and then we'll go home. Well, I get to the hospital, and like as I get there, I'm like, you know, what's going on with my husband? Like, can anyone tell me, like, what's happening? And they're like, we don't know. And, you know, I keep, you know, nudging them. Well, can you give me any information, anything? We don't know. And meantime, though, my kids come to the hospital. They tell me my kids are there. And they ask me, you know, if I want them to bring my kids in to see me. I said, yes, of course. They said, do you want me to bring them in as a group or one by one? I said, I think it's better that I speak to them one by one. So I bring them in one by one. I talk to each kid, and I reassure them that everything's fine. And they're like, but what about Abba? I'm like, Abba's fine. He's in the car. They're going to take him out, and then he's fine. And they're like, okay. You know, but they weren't convinced, because they were there longer than me, and they knew that something was wrong. I didn't know yet. Then finally, I'm asking the nurse for more information, and she says, well, we're getting some information now. Your husband is being transported. They're getting him out. They needed to take the jaws of life to cut apart the car, to take him out, to airlift him by helicopter to a trauma center, which was in Syracuse, New York. We were in Watertown, New York, about an hour or so from Syracuse. And they said, we're taking him to a trauma center because we suspect that he has a spinal cord injury. And I know I was in shock, and I know I was getting my faculties back slowly. Spinal cord injury didn't sound so good. I said to them, spinal cord injury, can he walk? And they look at me and they said, no. And at that point, I took probably the biggest deep breath that I ever took in my life. And I said, okay, I have two choices now. Choice number one, I crumble, which seemed like a pretty good idea at the time. Crumbling sounded really good. Or I swallow hard and I rise up to this challenge. And I do what I need to do and give what it takes to be there for my kids, because I have no idea what this is going to be like. And at that point, I knew nothing about spinal cord injury. Not really. All I knew was that he can't walk. So the picture in my mind I had was, you know, pushing around a cute little wheelchair. But what I did not realize is that when people can't walk, that's the least of their problems. There's all kinds of other health issues and health restraints and other kinds of conditions that come along with it that I so blessedly didn't know about at the time. So I'm like, okay, fine. So, you know, worst comes to worst, we'll push him around in a wheelchair. And I was like, okay, that's pretty horrible. But I was totally clueless. And at that point, I was like, okay, I am going to need to figure this out because I have 7 kids waiting on the other side of this curtain. One that's not born yet that they're making sure is okay. And one that I left at home that was on the phone with us just before we crashed, asking us when we'd be home. And we told him we're 1.5 hours from home. We'll be home in about 2 hours. And then that's when the screaming started. And he just heard screaming and lust. And the phone crashed, and that was all he knew. And that's where my life switched. It turned on a dime. And the title of tonight's class is I Didn't Sign Up For This. And that was pretty much what I thought. Like, I did not sign up for this. My husband was in ICU for 3 months. He stayed in the ICU in Syracuse for 5 weeks, after which they airlifted him to Ottawa, back home. You know, insurance sends you back home where it's cheaper for them to take care of you. And so he was in the ICU for 3 months. He was inpatient in the rehab for 6 months, and it wasn't until Pesach time that he was discharged from the rehab center. So this is like from Rosh Hashanah to Pesach, that he was in the rehab center trying to regain anything, something. And really for him at that point, it just really meant stabilizing him. He was dependent on a trach to breathe. He couldn't breathe independently on his own right after the accident. And there was a lot of trials and tribulations in the ICU, ups and downs, more downs than ups. And it was a very, very long, long, trying process. And I think we'll move on to other things. I'm not going to go into all the details right now, but just to give you the picture of life in a wheelchair is not just life in a wheelchair. It meant he was a quadriplegic. So it's not just that he couldn't walk, but he had little to no use of any of his 4 limbs. That's why it's called quadriplegic. So basically, anything, he was able to move like from his shoulders and up, and that's about it. And he had to be able to, he had OT, PT, speech therapy, he had to relearn how to breathe. He had to relearn how to speak. He had to relearn how to just move his arms up and down. He couldn't do that. He had to relearn how to be able to feed himself. He had to regain his strength. And that was all a process. And after he was discharged from the rehab center, he came home to live at home. Our home was not really accessible at all. So we lived under very tight and confining conditions until we were able to get a home that was outfitted for him to be able to have more independence and get around in his wheelchair. So, I didn't sign up for this. This wasn't how life was supposed to be. Like, life was supposed to be Hanukkah parties and Purim parties and Shabbatons. And it was hard. It was really, really hard. I had a newborn, you know, 3 months after the accident, my son was born. And Baruch Hashem, he was healthy and well, and everything that went along with, you know, his birth and bringing my husband home, taking care of a newborn, a whole family, and a very, very compromised spouse living on the other side of town because he was in a rehab center. And there were times like, I did not sign up for this. And I would say that. Like, you know, I would say it to friends, I would say it to family, like, this is not what I signed up for. But then something happened. I had gone to a meeting. There was like in one of the shuls, there was the Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation that does like the monthly, they have a monthly video that they put out with like
different topics and different speakers. And the speech of that month, I don't remember exactly where along the journey it was something about challenging times. So my friend suggested that I should go. You know, I'm like, yeah, I know about challenging times. No thanks, I don't need to go. So she's like, no, I think you could, you know, I don't know what it is either, but maybe, first of all, it'd be good for you to get out of the house. You'll get out, you'll see people, and, you know, maybe it'll give you some reason. So she kind of forced me to go, and I went. And here's something that I picked up at that speech that left me, it was like a lightning bolt. I called it like a lightning bolt, like a realization of something that maybe we've heard before, and sometimes we hear things and we see things and we learn things and we memorize things, but it takes a certain situation or a certain circumstance or a certain atmosphere for it to really hit home. So here's what I heard. I heard that, you know, and this was that when a person is born and they are about to enter this world, so 40 days before, the person is shown exactly what their life is going to be like, what their purpose as their neshama is, what they are going to fulfill. Kind of they get a preview of a video of what their life is going to be and everything that they are going to go through, the ups, the downs, the positives, the negatives, the trials, the tribulations, the sorrows, the joys. And the neshama says, yeah, I want to do that because I recognize that in order for me, my neshama, to be the best neshama that I can possibly be, which is ultimately our purpose here on this world, to be the best that we can, I see and I understand why all those things make sense. So yeah, I sign up for it. And if I tell you that even when I tell the story today, I still have shivers up my spine because when I heard the, yeah, I sign up for it, I was like, I signed up for this. Oh no. And the speech went on, but I don't remember anything else from the speech after that. You know, the video was over, someone flicked on the lights, everybody left, and I was sitting in the basement of the shul thinking, I signed up for this. I signed up for this. And I had been telling everyone, it's not like I said, hey, pick me, yeah. I want to be the one that's going to have the quadriplegic husband. No, I didn't. But lightning bolt told me I did. And when I heard that, it resonated with me. And it actually was a chizuk for me because I realized that as much as I didn't think I signed up for this, I did. And somehow, deep down, my neshama knew that this was something that I needed to fulfill my tachlis, our tachlis as a family in this world. And I just sat there. So I did sign up for this. And I guess once I signed up for it, I guess I'm pretty competitive. I decided, well, if I signed up for this, by golly, I'm going to be the best at this as I can be. I have no idea what that means. There's no manuals. There's no guideline. There was no rules like what to do when all your caregivers cancel on you and there's no one to take care of your family. I don't know. Okay, so we figured it out. And that's when I had, you know, some techniques which I'll share with you, some things that helped me get through the hard times, the horrific times, but they are things that can also help us get through on a daily basis. Because sometimes people would tell me, you know, Shandel, I feel bad to fetch to you because you're going through X, Y, and Z, but I don't know what to do. My washing machine broke. And I'm like, it's okay. Like, I'm still me. I can relate. That's horrible. Like, when your washing machine breaks and, like, you have mounds of laundry to do and there isn't a clean pair of pants in the house for your kid or something, I get that. You know, I'm still normal. Like, I'm still regular. Like, I didn't want people to, like, look at me as anything else. So there are things that we can do to get through all those day-to-day things that we all get through doing. But one more thing before I get to that. I'm a teacher. And I was preparing for Chumash class one day, and I was teaching Parshas Ve'eschanan. And in Parshas Ve'eschanan,
we learn how Moshe was davening and davening and davening and davening because he wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael. And certainly Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the Anav Mikol Adam, who learned and received the Torah directly from Hashem on Har Sinai, was up on Har Sinai three times for 40 days each, knew and understood.